So, good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society on Penny Isler. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services that are either presented by a Prairie member, like we are today, or by somebody from the wider community, or by our consulting minister, Sandra Ingham. Ah, just in time. Okay, later in the service, we'll have time for welcoming visitors and guests. It's not a requirement, but we want to get to know you better, so. This morning, our opening words. Until the great masses of people shall be filled with a sense of responsibility for each other's welfare, social justice can never be attained. Helen Keller. I'd like to invite Orange and Dean Schroeder up to do our global chalice lighting.
And we've in turn invited our special friend Carolyn Briggs to actually light the chalice for us today, and we welcome her. We are Unitarians, so what do we celebrate?
We celebrate the faithful way of love, freedom, and truth.
We celebrate the message of tolerance and equality.
We celebrate all missions to unite faiths, cultures, and peoples in the face of division and exclusion.
We celebrate the pioneers of social justice for speaking out their reason, often at the risk of losing their career, reputation, or even their life.
We celebrate how unique, mysterious, and powerful each life is.
We celebrate gracious humility learnt without the imposition of guilt or failure.
We celebrate the beauty of the earth and the impossibility of the universe.
We celebrate the potential for good of the local and global community.
We celebrate the rich diversity of each country.
We celebrate our meetings of peaceful fellowship.
We celebrate the gift of laughter, and we celebrate because there are infinite reasons to celebrate.
So, in July, ADA is going to be 25 years old. And to commemorate that, we wanted to do a service. I'm going to take part of the service here and the presentation and give a brief history of ADA in the US. And Lori's going to do a more personal side to the story. Lori Bond is a member of Prairie. And so, like all human rights struggles for the Americans with Disabilities Act has a long history, and the struggle will probably never be finished. In colonial U.S., the care of the disabled was a responsibility of the family. However, fear, shame, and lack of understanding led some families to hide or disown their disabled members or allow them to die. For those individuals whose families were unable or unwilling to support them, a system was developed to farm them out to people who received public assistance to provide room, board, and care. This system survived until the latter part of the 19th century. Public's concern over abuses, including recorded cases where care providers collected their fees and locked the people with disabilities in attics to starve or freeze to death. Eventually, this led to a change in focus, a shift towards more organized, institutionalized care began in the 1820s. The term warehousing, sometimes used to describe the type of treatment, and it refers to the fact that most such care was custodial in nature and resulted from a view of people with disabilities as defective, incompetent, and in need of special institutions, care, and services which isolated them in society in order for them to survive. Specialized institutions for individuals with particular types of disabilities were developed, like homes for the blind or the deaf, and these also were custodial in nature. This pattern of institutionalization has fallen into disrepute for two principal reasons. The first, individuals living in these institutions were subject to abuse and neglect on a massive scale. Second, and even more fundamental, it was not the purpose of these institutions to promote the productivity or the independence of those residing in them, because the prevailing concept of disability at the time assumed that to attempt to do so would be futile. The protective isolation model operated on the assumption that people with disabilities needed protection from the hardships of society. As medicine improved over time, it meant that patients survived injuries and diseases that would have, instead of dying. World War I and II, the Korean and Vietnam War, meant that more veterans were returning with disabilities. The large number of resulting disabled changed attitudes on rehabilitation for return to work as being an appropriate goal. There were advances in rehabilitation services. Advocacy morphed from charities for specific disabilities run by the non-disabled into coalition of all the disability types run by the disabled themselves seeking civil rights. Then the 1973 Rehabilitation Act and Section 504 of it, and this served as a later model for ADA, was a significant milestone in the civil rights of the disabled. I have to share a personal story here. I remember when that started, and we were visiting Bill's grandparents up in Grand Rapids, and we were in our late 20s about then, and they were in their 70s, and they took us shopping. And as they drove by the handicapped parking spots to go further out, they explained to us that that parking was for old people. And we had a big laugh about that, because at that time, 70 seemed like the very definition of old to us. So, anyway. And then Senator Tom Harkin authored ADA and was its chief sponsor in the Senate. Harkin delivered part of his introduction speech in sign language, saying it was so his deaf brother could understand. It was signed into the law on July 26, 1990, by then President George H.W. Bush. The ADA is a wide-ranging civil rights law that prohibits discrimination based on disability. It affords similar protections against discrimination to Americans with disabilities as the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which made discrimination based on race, religion, sex, national origin, and other characteristics illegal. In addition, unlike the Civil Rights Act, the ADA also requires covered employers to provide reasonable accommodation to employees with disability and imposes accessibility requirements on public accommodations. Googling ADA is where I got started getting into the weeds. There are pages upon pages upon pages of dry compliance regulations by every government agency and an endless list of lawsuits. One result of all the lawsuits was the ADA Amendment Act of 2008, signed by, ironically, George W. Bush. With this act, Congress overturned several Supreme Court decisions that Congress believed had interpreted the definition of a disability too narrowly, resulting in a denial of protection for individuals with impairments such as cancer, diabetes, epilepsy. It also directed the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunities Commission to amend ADA regulations to reflect the changes made by the ADA Amendment Act. In reflecting upon ADA after 25 years, Senator Harkin's committee commissioned a report that takes a closer look at the population that came of age since the passage of ADA, including their experiences with education, disability benefits, and transition programs, and participation in the workforce. The report outlines four key areas of opportunity to improve support for members of the ADA generation. And in Senator Harkin's words, it is increasing support for high school students as they transition into the workforce, improving their experience as they enter post-secondary education in the labor market, changing the requirements in disability benefits that may discourage young people with disabilities from working, and leveraging employer demand while establishing supportive workplaces. Preparing the ADA generation to compete in today's labor force must begin while they're in school, providing them with access to early work experiences and internships are just two ways that will help them succeed. Higher education plays a critical role in helping young people attain employment, and that is especially true for young people with disabilities. Yet, only 15% of high school graduates with disabilities attend four-year colleges, compared to the over 30% of the general population. Connecting our talented young people with appropriate post-secondary opportunities, including certificate programs, career and technical training opportunities, community colleges, 2- and 4-year degree programs will help them enter the labor market with the skills and knowledge they need to compete successfully. Changing the incentives of disability benefits is another critical priority we must take up to help the ADA generation succeed. Under the current system, this one blew my mind, people with disabilities must prove that they cannot and will not be able to earn enough to support themselves to receive personal attendance services. And their support, that this support would allow them to be independent. This essentially commits them to a lifetime of poverty. We need to modernize these programs so that young people are not punished for wanting to work. Another barrier to employment the ADA generation faces is a perceived cost of worst place accommodation. Employers often overestimate these costs while underestimating the contribution workers with disabilities can make. In actuality, nearly 80% of workplace accommodations cost less than $1,000. And studies have shown that hiring employees with disabilities can increase business productivity and decrease absenteeism. In fact, young people with disabilities often thrive in competitive environments and leadership positions, adding value to the workplace far beyond the cost of any accommodation that they need. And I'd like to end up with my experiences this end of April at the People of Faith United for Justice Advocacy Day at the Capitol. I learned about another privatization scheme in the governor's budget that would dismantle Wisconsin's top-rated long-term care system, including the elimination of IRIS, a program which was started in 2008 to provide a non-managed care, free market alternative for people who want to self-direct all of their service. And this popular, unique, and flexible program has grown rapidly to its current enrollment of 11,500 Wisconsin residents, and enabling them to live at home instead of in nursing homes. Good news, I heard on the news Friday that the budget committee has found that the governor's proposal is unaccepted, and for now, IRIS is safe. So that's the nuts and bolts of it. And Lori can give us the personal side of it now. And then we'll have questions.
one of the things I said to Pete was, I didn't know if I could roll on top of this carpet. I have mashed carpets rolling on top because they get caught in my wheels. So, and also the pattern I can't look at. I think, first of all, I have to take my glasses off so I can read my notes. I'm just going to tell you a little about my disabilities. I have several, and a lot of them have to do with, brain damage. I did not know I was born with hydrocephalus back in the late 50s. Of course, they didn't have the technology back then to say, hey, this kid's got hydrocephalus. I became disabled completely 21 years ago, last month. Again, I thought it was from the hydrocephalus, but now, a few years ago, they tell me, no, that was MS, multiple sclerosis. I'm right now in what they call the secondary progressive MS. So when I asked what that meant, they said, well, that just means that the lesions in your brain are growing faster and faster. So I have, I'm one of these people that cannot work. And I'm glad Penny talked about the, the right to work statutes and what that means. Because there are several of us who simply cannot. And I worked for the state. I was a probation parole agent. And one day I was out, I had to have a car back then. I got into a series of car accidents identical. And of course I studied the brain in college. I have a master's degree in counseling, bachelor's degree in social work. So studied the brain and said, okay, so I'm trying to make a lane change. I don't see the car. I make the lane change, and I get hit. That happened 4 times. And of course, then at that point, I asked one of the police officers that I routinely worked with, do you think I should give up my license? I don't know what's going on here. Even though I had been seeing a series of different doctors since I started having nosebleeds every day, every same time of the day, and just while at work. And at first I said, oh, nothing is wrong. And each time I saw a doctor, there was one further thing wrong. And nobody at that time said MS. So I thought I was on disability for hydrocephalus. Turns out now they tell me, no, you had MS starting from day one. That's when it kicked in. So not only do I have hydrocephalus, which means the more activity I engage in, the more pressure on my brain. And I can just shut down really quickly. And I have MS. I'm also missing the piece of the brain that connects the two halves. So it takes a little longer for me to comprehend things. So the fact that I got a master's degree, the doctors can't figure that out, how I managed to get through school. But I did, and I worked, from the time I was 17, I worked in office jobs. My parents knew I had the disability, but never told me. And so they steered me into office positions. I hated office work. So went back to school at 23, got that master's degree. And as I said before, I worked as a probation parole agent. And the other thing is I'm also legally blind. I have this condition called blepharospasm, that one of the reasons I took my glasses off, and one of the reasons I had them put the chairs, they originally the chairs were in a semicircle, and I said, no, that's not going to work for me. The more colors I see, the more people I see, the more stimulation to my brain, the worse it is. And that has caused me to have two strokes. So the last time I was in the hospital, two doctors have said, they're amazed I'm still alive with all that has happened. And of course I flippantly said to them, to one, we never know when we're gonna die. And, you know, it could happen today, it could happen tomorrow. We don't know. And to another, I said, well, there must be something I have to do yet. Maybe giving this presentation was one of those things I had to do yet. So I feel like I'm kind of rambling on. But how the ADA has affected my life, and I'm going to add to what Penny said too. 1973, the other people working with Tom Harkin were Ted Kennedy and Bob Dole. And as you all remember, Bob Dole was disabled in the war. And the fact that they were polar opposites in politically thinking, they were right on when, in terms of looking at people with disabilities and including them in society, passing this Americans with Disabilities Act. And it took many, many years, as Penny said, for that to happen. when I went on disability, I wasn't aware of the Americans with Disabilities Act. I just knew this is who I am, this is the way it is. And what's important to remember about the ADA is that it is a federal program. Businesses have to comply with the, and schools have to comply with its standards, but churches do not. And that's because of the theoretical separation of church and state in our society. Although I find it interesting that our money says, in God we trust. Yeah. It's like, yeah. There's, to me, there is no separation. But that's why churches don't have to have ramps. They don't have to, do the things that we here at Prairie do just because it's the right thing to do. I've also noticed, the Quaker community in this city also has said, we don't need the ADA to tell us what to do. We know, and we know how to make things right for people. And I think that's really important. The other thing I wanted to talk about too was, the provisions in that ADA Act. There are others besides education and that sort of thing. Curb cutaways came into existence back then. And it's interesting to note that the bus I would have to take here, one of the reasons I take paratransit, and I'll talk about paratransit in a minute, is the bus stop there does not have a curb cutaway. And this is 25 years later in a progressive city like Madison. The curb cutaways around the inside of the square are very, very scary. In fact, I have knocked off the power in my wheelchair because it got caught going down one. because of course you have to go down and then up to get into the road. And for that to happen so close to our state capital, again, it's one of those, what's going on here? Who's thinking? You know, I mean, I'm thinking that, and Penny kind of alluded to this, that with Walker, things are going, you know, I mean, he's eradicated a lot of things, and I'm afraid that he may, or his cronies may, try to eradicate all that we've worked for and done with the ADA. I don't know what's going to happen with that. And of course, building code. Those buildings, especially apartment buildings, apartments, now have to have 3% of their units be totally wheelchair accessible. Those built after 1991. And it was interesting, I just called a new apartment. I saw a new apartment building go up in the neighborhood. I want to get back downtown, you know, say, you know, high rise. And I asked, well, do you have any, do you have any wheelchair accessible apartments? Oh, they're all wheelchair accessible. But every single one of them has a bathtub. And I said, do you realize that you are in violation of the law? Silence. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. And, you know, Penny talked a lot about the history of the ADA, and you know, my feeling on the ADA too is that it is an enhanced version, you know, of the separate but equal legislation passed in the 1950s, and it is, you know, part of the whole civil rights struggle. But and I appreciate the efforts of those who have worked tirelessly. When I became disabled, actually, there was somebody who said to me, oh, so now you're going to work for people with disabilities. I said, no. Just because I'm disabled, that doesn't mean I'm going to focus all my energy on that. Of course, now, 21 years later, I don't have much energy. So all I can do is, you know, sit back and fortunately the ADA, accessibility coordinator for the city is a good friend of mine, lives in the building next to me. He and I at one point had talked about going down, you know, to the square so he could make notes. It would have to be on the outer square. And present those, you know, to his boss, the mayor. We have yet to do that. I asked him about that just the other day, and he said, you know, I'm so busy with everything else. So that work still needs to happen. The curb cutaways, the as an example. And one of the things that I've noticed and what people have said to me was, you know, gee, the diamonds in the road, you know, in the curb cutaways, actually they served a purpose. They were put there for people who are blind so that they're, you know, if they use a white cane, their cane can feel that. Not in winter around here. So that's why you see more metal in the curb cutaways with the raised buttons. I've spent time walking one of those canes. When I walk, I go blind. Of course, now I can't walk anymore. As you know, I used a service dog. And that, too, was also addressed in this legislation. Most recently, and I'm not quite sure when this happened, but the service dog language was taken out to be amended to service animal, because it's not just dogs who help people with disabilities. Monkeys have been shown to help people with disabilities who have no use of their hands, as an example. I've heard of people using Shetland ponies. I don't remember the reason why. But again, there's been a lot of abuse of that. You know, there are schools where service dogs, guide dogs, are being trained. My dog, you know, back when I had her, was called owner-trained service dog. And because there's been a lot of abuse of that, that has been tightened, and I was part of that. Mark Miller came to me and said, how can we fix this legislation to prevent abuse? And I said, well, Mark, here's what we can do. Because my dog could do, you know, a lot of things for me. And I said to him, and I know others have said, and it's been amended to, if it's an owner-trained service animal, it's got to perform three functions that help you with your disability. And one of my friends kind of joked to me, you know, your dog does that in the space of 10 minutes. And I know some of you remember her. I brought her here a couple times toward the end of her life. And she did it. I remember going into a Home Depot where, you know, they had a no dogs allowed. And I was walking with her. And one of their employees approached me and at the last minute saw her take her snout and move my and turn my leg, because she knew where we were going. He walked away. And with her there, I carried the statutes, questions and answers for people and businesses that was put out by the Department of Justice. I always carried that so I could show that to the, you know, if I had problems. And you better believe I went to the managers at Home Depot and said, look at this. It never happened again. Because they said, oh yeah. Service dogs do not need to have a vest on. But we just do it because then there's no question. You know, it's one thing that's not required by law. So anyway, I'll stop talking about service animals. And another point that I wanted to make, I wanted to talk about the different words that we use, that are used. Disabled, a disabled person. Invalid, if you look at it on paper, it's invalid. And I have friends to this day who use that to describe themselves. And I just cringe. Several years ago, I think toward the end of the 80s, probably starting with the mid-70s with the women's movement, came the term differently abled. And I remember sitting, being with two of my friends, one who was disabled from polio, the effects of polio at 3 weeks, and one who had progressive MS. At that time, I didn't know I too had it. And we talked about, what do we call ourselves? And each one of us had a different terminology. And we said, for me, I like person with a disability. And you see that in literature too, shorthanded to PWD. I'm a person first. I have a disability, or in my case, several disabilities. But I am a person first. I was going to talk about paratransit. We are lucky here in Madison that we have as good a paratransit system as we'd want. It's not perfect, but I have had very few problems with it. One of the reasons I get here early on Sunday morning is if I don't schedule my ride by 9 o'clock, I'm not gonna get here because they don't have enough drivers. The city only has so much money and there are only two providers on the weekends, whereas during the week there's four, I believe. And it only costs me $3.25 each way. Whereas I was talking with a friend that I knew who had cerebral palsy. I knew her in high school. We were good friends. And she said, believe it or not, for her, the paratransit is $40. And this is in a small city the size of the campus here, the city I grew up in. I, occasionally think about moving back there. And to be with my family, that's where they're all at. But I couldn't get it any better than living here. We have a good service. We have good things for for people with disabilities. In fact, when Dave Cheslevich was running for mayor, I went to a breakfast where all of the mayoral candidates were, and I had my dog with me. And if you remember Sue Bauman, she saw that dog, she turned around and gave me the dirtiest look. And this breakfast was put on by, I believe it was Alliance for Animals. And so I knew several people in there. Dave Cheslevich came to me, got down on both knees and said, what can I do for people with disabilities? And I said, Dave, there's not enough time right now to talk about it. But one thing Dave did was appoint me to be on the Commission on People with Disabilities. I served on that commission for a couple of years, I believe. We tried to pass something in the city that apartment buildings had to have 5% of their units be wheelchair accessible, totally wheelchair accessible. And they were talking about that until I got appointed. And I said, you know, this is never going to fly. And here's why. The federal government only says 3%. And an attorney came to talk to us about that. And that's exactly what he said, that Madison cannot have it any better than the federal government regulations. Even though Madison has tried to get a lot of better things, the playground Penny was talking about. My hope, I don't know what kind of flooring that they'll have. This thing, you know, cannot go over pea gravel without me getting stuck. I can't ride in the grass without getting stuck. So I do believe those will be having just a fine layer of bark on them, because that is the most accessible. Material to have on the ground. And one of the final things, one of the personal things, normally you see me come in without shoes on. That again, if there's a business that says no shoes, no shirt, no service, doesn't apply to those of us who use wheelchairs. Our feet are not going to touch the ground, for the most part. And I know friends who've had fun with that when approached shoes. Nope, don't need them. So I think I'm going to stop there. I know I kind of rambled on, and I have 3 pages of notes. Tried to keep it concise and that, but you know, the ADA has a long way to go, just like any other legislation. And now I'll put my glasses on, and if you have any questions or discussion.
Thank you, Lori. For our closing words, I have a quote from Stephen Hawking. My advice to other disabled people would be, concentrate on your disabilities doesn't prove you doing well. You don't regret the things it interferes with. Don't be disabled in spirit as well as in physicality. That's it. Greet your neighbor and stay for Soup Sunday and Mrs. Meeting.